My name is Jody Kretzman, and we're going to do a session, sort of an introduction to economics in black and white. And it's going to be, at least for my first half hour of it or so, and I really do want to have some time for some interchange. What I'd really like to do is to speak almost in headline fashion with you about a number of different ways in which economic categories and ways of looking at the world intersect with racial categories. Okay, one of the ongoing controversies in social science that a lot of you are familiar with has to do with the whole interaction of race as a cause for inequality versus class for a cause for inequality. The race-class kind of argument. Which is more important? Is it more important to think about categories, for particularly for people interested in social justice? Is it more important to start with categories of poverty and class and talk about all of the ways in which people are divided between the wealthy and poor? Or do you start with racial categories? And that debate now is raging not only among white academics, but within the black community as well. Probably the most controversial social science book out of the black community in the last few years was written by a black sociologist at the University of Chicago named Bill Wilson, a book called The Declining Significance of Race, in which he argues, in fact, that a lot of the understanding of what's going on in racial dynamics needs to be based on an understanding of economics and class, at least alongside of race, okay? So we're talking about a complex set of interactions here this morning. The other thing I would say to begin with is I have an understanding of racism not as something that sort of exists a priori, but as something that we recreate daily as a society. We reinvent it daily. Our institutions reinvent racism daily. It's not something that sort of is somehow imposed on us from the outside. The face of racism, the way in which black folks and other people of color in the United States interact with majority cultures in the United States, changes over time. It's much different now than it was in the 19th century. And it's much different, in fact, in 1987 than it was, I think, in 1970. So that part of being engaged as people of the rainbow in trying to bring about some kind of social justice and equality among the races, I think also demands of us the struggle to keep ourselves as abreast as we can be of the changing face and dynamics of racism, right? Larry McClellan here in the is going to be teaching some sessions, I think, on housing patterns and suburban-urban kind of stuff later on in the week, invented a game in the late 60s, 68, something like that, which was then called the Ghetto Game. Later called Urban Dynamics, in which the dynamics of race and class were sort of played out with all sorts of rules governing that by groups of players. And there were blacks and whites and different owners and public government actors and so forth and so on. But my guess is, Larry, that if you were to reinvent that game today, that it really would be different. That some of the dynamics of race and class have shifted so radically in the last 19 years since you first did that, that the process of reinventing that game would lead one into understanding how we have reinvented racism, right, over the last few years. So that's the premise. The premise is that we reinvent racism every day, that our structures and institutions do that with us, and that it's part of our challenge to understand how that works. Other assumption is that you really can't talk about racism without talking about economics. Because from the first moment of black folks' arrival in the United States, the first packing up of the ships on the shores of Africa, the function of slavery was understood primarily as an economic function. Right? The understanding the status of black folks in the United States is always first, for me, understanding their place as labor in the economy. So we're not all going to become instant expert labor economists this morning, but I do want us to think about that way of understanding how it is that blacks fit into the rest of the society and what the relations and dynamics of between cultures are like. So with those introductory things said, I just want to touch on sort of four different angles into the question of economics and race. I want to touch briefly, expand on the point I just made on the intimate way in which the status of black people is connected with the stages of economic development in particularly the United States, first thing. Second thing I want to do is to just give us an overall large brush sense of how the economics of inequality are working themselves out today and where we sort of are over a 30, 40 year period. Are we getting better? Is it getting worse? What sort of indicators can we look at to figure out where the economy of racism is in the United States, at least today, okay? So we'll talk a little bit about inequality. I want to then talk a little bit about what seems to me the major challenge to social justice concerned people today, and the major different way in which economics and race overlap in the United States, and that is the creation of what some people call the underclass. I'm not very comfortable with that term, but it does, it seems to me, represent a new kind of poverty that our economy has managed to create, and I want to think a little bit with you about that phenomenon and what it might mean. And finally, I want to make just a couple of points about the globalization of our economy and what that might have to do with our thinking about multicultural realities. Okay, those four things. And really in headline form and with, I hope, some examples to touch on. Then I hope we have some time that you can lead us back into any of the categories and expand them and take it anywhere you want to. Okay, number one. The labor market theory of racism tells us that to understand how blacks fit into the economy at any given moment in history, what one has to do is to figure out where they are working and what function they're performing in the economy. Basically, we've got, the history of racism in the United States is that they're always at the bottom. They were brought here as owned labor, not even cheap labor, but owned labor. After emancipation, the construction of Jim Crow meant for blacks really a continuation of economic slavery, but with some opportunities for small sharecropping and agricultural entrepreneurial activity in the South, all right? But as has always happened in the history of the United States, when blacks get into an economic sector, the economic sector itself is almost ready to die, so that you begin to have then, at the very beginning of the 20th century and accelerating all the way through the 1950s, the mechanization of agriculture, the whole shift in how people grow things, the decline of the cotton economy, the need for fewer workers, the impossibility, the crisis today of the small family farm is nothing new to black folks. They went through that for the whole 50 years in the South, beginning with about World War I. So that with the collapse of the Southern agricultural economy, you have the greatest internal migration in the history of the United States of a people from the agricultural South into mostly first northern cities, now interestingly enough into southern cities. And when black folks come into the northern cities in two great waves around the war, they step into industrial jobs, right? This is a real fast economic history. Industrial jobs mostly vacated by whites who were at war, right? To bolster the war economy, blacks step into those jobs, and it's not too many decades before those jobs themselves begin to disappear. So what I want to spend just a minute about now is sharing with you what you already know, which is the greatest economic dislocation trend of the last 25 years and how that impacts on black folks. Black folks begin by the end of World War II, and the into the early 50s to get a toehold in the blue-collar northern cities. They're into steel, they're into heavy manufacturing, they're into auto in Detroit, they're into a whole lot of the sort of basic blue-collar industries and beginning to push. It's not very long after blacks begin to get a toehold in the blue-collar north that the process that we've come to sort of call deindustrialization begins to happen, right? And that whole industrial base, that whole organization of work begins to collapse. And that process, beginning somewhere around 1960 and accelerating through this very moment, has meant the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs in just my city alone, Chicago, and all over, particularly the North, but now increasingly the Sun Belt and the South as well. The basis for entry into the economy, which immigrant group after immigrant group, including the first waves of black immigrants into the northern cities from the South, that basis of the economy is disappearing. So what we're now having is a different kind of city. Now that black folks are about, they are the most urbanized population in the United States, about 65 now percent of black folks live in cities. Now that the black population is urbanized, the job sector, which drew them to the cities in the first place, has almost collapsed totally. Right? To be replaced by what? To be replaced, I think, by a kind of dual city. The economic function of American cities at this point, I think if you think about it, you can see it in the downtowns. And it's as true of Seattle and San Francisco as it is of Chicago and New York and even places like Detroit and St. Louis that are more bombed out. The economic function of those cities now is no longer to make things, but it is to control, command, and communicate. Think about those downtowns as having a triple C function: controlling, commanding, and communicating structures in the economy, which are increasingly concentrated and increasingly global in scope. So you no longer have northern cities filled with neighborhoods that have jobs with people making things in them. You have now cities with giant towers downtown, right, where people go in and push paper, right, basically. Nobody makes anything in those towers downtown, in any downtown tower that I know. I've never seen anybody making anything. They push paper, they command, they control, they person an incredible network of communications. Right? Now that's a whole new sector of labor. The good jobs in that service sector, in that service economy, require increasing levels of skill and expertise to get into them, right? So that at the same time, then, as you have an education system which is deteriorating and not giving skills for entry into the new economic system, you have an economic system whose standards for the better-paying jobs, at any rate, are getting higher and higher. You have at the same time a production of a whole series of jobs at the base of that economy, which are much more menial, much less brain-requiring, and much lower paying than any of the industrial jobs ever were, and than any of the blue collar. The new service economy that we hear so much about is mostly jobs that pay. What did we find out from the latest Congressional Budget Office study last year that something like 70% of the new jobs created pay under $7,000 a year over the last 5 years. So that the great Reagan Revolution that is supposed to be creating these 8 million jobs from 1980 to the present, of those jobs, something like 70% of them pay under $7,000 a year. They're clearly part-time, they're clearly make work. It's sort of, I've begun to think about this as the McDonaldization of labor, right? That the new model for what entry-level labor is about is in fact work at McDonald's. And not work for black folks in those shining and gleaming new towers in our downtowns. Right? What this has meant it seems to me, is an increasing class-based, economics-based split in American cities that to some degree transcends racial lines. Right? What we've been talking here about, I think, and I want to get back to it in a minute, is the creation by the movement of the economy from an industrial economy to a post-industrial service-centered economy, the creation of this underclass. And I want to get back to that in just a second. Let me bracket that, though, for a moment to just think with you for a second about a few numbers, about where we are overall in race and economics in 1987. I think that in general, you know, you're always sort of, you think about this question, are things getting better or worse? I mean, are there reasons to be more angry than we used to be, or what? I mean, what's going on with poverty and race? It seems to me that in general, if you look at the measures of inequality, that is, any kind of measure, black income versus white income, or percentage of blacks in poverty, or any of the sort of usual indicators, over time, you see a kind of a line that would go like this. That is that, say if you started in 1940, something like 70% of all black families in 1940 lived under the poverty line. 70%. By 1950 or so, with the boost in the World War II that the World War II made in the economy, particularly in the industrial economy, that percentage, 70%, goes down to about 54% of black families living in poverty by 50. Doesn't go down too much in the 1960s, so that by 1960 or so, you've got something like 48% of blacks living in poverty, black families living in poverty. With the Civil Rights Movement and the Great Society legislation, for all of the attempt to rewrite history that's going on in the Reagan administration right now, that percentage of black families in poverty by 1970 had gone down to 32%. The 1970s leveled off so that by 1980, about 30% of black families are in poverty. And what we've seen basically since 1980 is a slight rise in the poverty rate and in virtually every other indicator of inequality. In fact, some indicators say it's not so slight. So that as best we can figure out, by the end of 86, about 34% of black families are in poverty. So there's clearly some backsliding going on. Here are the numbers, I think, from 60s, 70s, 80s. Taking a look at another kind of indicator, unemployment among black males. In 1960 at 9%, in 1970 all the way down to 4%. In the early 1980s, in the Reagan recession of 82, 83, 84, it goes up to about 19% and then has come back down a little bit to 16%, when the overall unemployment rate is something like 7%. The pattern is like, I don't have the immediate numbers in my mind, but the pattern of percentage of college graduates who are black, right, is like this pattern, particularly since 1980. Let me just take a quick look at 1980 to 1986, the rise in the percentage of blacks graduating from college first leveled off for a couple of years and now has dipped significantly, so that a lot of people in higher education are clearly worried about that as a problem. One other measure of where we are in the 80s, these statistics are, I think, telling. They include not just black folks, but your basic poverty and inequality statistics. The poorest, in constant dollars, the poorest 40% of the population lost $236 on an average in family income. This is from 1980 to 85. The wealthiest 40% of the population gain $2,195 on the average in family income. And the wealthiest 10%, part of that 40, obviously, but the 10%, the wealthiest 10%, the average family income went up $7,130.
It's one.
For a family of four, I think I was going to say 17. I think about 17 for a family of four. But this is one indicator of a growing gap between the wealthy and the poor in the 1980s. And there are lots of other indicators that, that tell us about a growing gap, again, between white and black in the 1980s. So in general, we've got a kind of curve that tells us about progress sort of through 1970. Slow, certainly, but progress nonetheless. And then a kind of leveling off through the 70s and a real kind of regression over the last 7 or 8 years. I think that overall, that's a defensible way to understand how we're doing in our struggle to end equality. The answer is we're not doing real well right at the moment. Any other questions on that? There are lots of other numbers we can do.
Just one comment.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's not just social programs. That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. It's nothing to build on. It is nothing to build on. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of question among economists about, obviously, what sort of economy you're building if you're building a war economy. Yeah, Ken?
Given the issue of inequality, what kind of trend does white people
want? Well, one of the things particularly about, I mean... The interesting thing about, for instance, the black unemployment rate and the poverty rate of families is that the recovery that followed the Reagan recession, 82 to 84, the recovery that we know about from 85, 86, and now into 87, seems to have, for the most part, left the black community behind. So that a lot of the white statistics, if you factor out simply white employment rates, are much better, have gone back down to something like 6%, with all the problems with that statistic, but the white unemployment rate is something like 6% at this point, where the black unemployment rate continues to hover around between 15 and 20.
Those two curves are not following.
No, that's right, they're going in opposite directions, seems like at this point, or at least the recovery that whites are on, blacks have not participated in.
Is it really that blacks haven't participated in it, or that there's a larger percentage of blacks that have not participated?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're always talking
middle
about...
Middle class blacks have continued to rise in income.
To some degree. Not nearly as fast as white incomes have gone up. We might want to get into that question when we talk about the underclass in a second.
You were talking about the white family living below the income line. Mm-hmm. So you're probably going to talk about this a little bit. But the drastic increase is probably about 30%.
Some of these questions are leading me into the next section, which makes some sense. Let's want to do something.
Well, just about the white curve, you said was opposite of the black. And I'd be interested in seeing that broken down on a class basis also to see what's happening to lower class whites. Because my feeling is that they're stuck in some of the same situations that the black blacks.
I think that's right. Whenever we're talking about economic class here, we're not just talking race. Mm-hmm. We're talking across a lot of different categories. Any other comments on this particular thing? We can come back into it, but then I want to talk a little bit about the question of the underclass. We all right? Is that where we are now? Okay. Um, I think I want to start by recalling that my own understanding of the underclass has to do with the way we started. That is, it is a direct result of massive shifts in the way our economy is working. Okay, but let me get back in a moment to questions about the causes, because if we're going to address doing something about poverty and particularly about the question of the underclass, we do have to understand something about the causes. But let me start first with a portrait. I decided that maybe the easiest thing to do is to just indicate to you one of the neighborhoods that I know well in Chicago, and talk about for just a second the dimensions of an underclass neighborhood in the city of Chicago. And I've chosen a neighborhood in Chicago on the south side called Robert Taylor Homes. There are neighborhoods after neighborhoods after neighborhood in places like Chicago and other cities that are like this, although Robert Taylor, I think, for many reasons, is a kind of exaggerated version of even the normal kind of new poor community. But it's striking and it's compelling, and for me, I don't know, it's just heavy stuff. Robert Taylor Homes is a row of 28 buildings, each of which is 16 stories high.
And it's
public housing. It was built in the 1950s, and it was built clearly on the principle of the lowest cost per square foot. They're old cinder block buildings. They're now about 30 years old and crumbling. They have there are two elevators in each of the buildings. Most of the time, only one of the elevators is functioning, and very often none of the elevators is functioning. There are no habitable play lots around these buildings. They stretch endlessly, very close to each other. The corridors on the buildings are all on the outside of the building. So you take the elevator up and you get out onto an outside kind of a porch or corridor. There's no internal corridor in the building. And then the doors to the apartments go in from the outside corridor. Are you following me? With nothing but a little iron fence between the 16th floor outside corridor and the ground. The population of Robert Taylor Homes is officially 20,000 people, but it's clear that most of the people who live there understand that there are at least 10,000 more people who live there unofficially in various ways. The structure of the welfare system is such that, as well as other factors, it's such that it pays lots of folks, particularly black males, to remain as invisible as possible, right? So that insofar as there are black males residing in public housing, Robert Taylor Homes, they are largely invisible. There are 4,200 registered families in the building. They are all black. There is nothing but black folks in this set of homes. 72% of the population of the building is minor. We're talking under 16, 16 or under. 72% 16 or under. The median income per family is $4,900. And families often range up to 10, 11 folks. 90% of the family units, of the 4,200 family units in Robert Taylor Homes, are headed by females, and there is no male around. 81% of the 4,200 families are on aid for dependent children as their major source of income. 60% of the
4,900, the median income includes
welfare. Yeah. 60% of the adults in the in Robert Taylor Homes are unemployed, and almost all of the employed people in Robert Taylor Homes are underemployed. An indication of the way daily life goes in Robert Taylor Homes. I just took out of the crime statistics. 0.5% of Chicago's population lives in Robert Taylor Homes. 0.5% of the population. That 0.5% of the population accounts for 11% of the murders in the city of Chicago, It accounts for 9% of the rapes in the city of Chicago. It accounts for 10% of the aggravated assaults in the city of Chicago. So we have here an incredible concentration of oppressed folks with no resources to deal with making life happen. Oh, absolutely. There ain't no white folks in these statistics. Black on black crime. Now, this is about as bad as it gets in American cities today, I think. There are a few other projects around in Chicago and New York and Detroit that are a lot like this. But there are also neighborhoods that I think we can sort of talk about as new poor or underclass neighborhoods that are not quite as bleak as this, where there's some breaks in the pattern. Does anybody want to just, any reactions to that portrait?
Any influence from the church-based
Muslims,
the
Well, let me just say, and Kim and others who work in the city can talk about this too. My own astonishment in working in places like Robert Taylor doesn't have to do with this list of stuff. It has to do with the incredible people that are in there, the incredibly bright, aggressive, capacity-filled folk. Well, it's a whole, the history of public housing is a really interesting history to know about, and maybe Larry might talk a little bit about this later, but it's, you know, a vision out of the 1930s that everybody deserves housing. It's a charitable and altruistic vision about the housing problem. And in fact, a lot of the early public housing developments in northern cities are still today marvelously humane communities. They're low rises, they're two and three stories at most, they're townhouses, and they were thought about as way stations for poor people of many colors, not just black, poor people on their way into the private housing market, right? Kind of stopgap measures. But that all got perverted by a series of I think planning mistakes and maybe not mistakes having to do with the politics of race, so that from some points of view it made sense to do something like Robert Taylor Homes, one theory in Chicago has it that this was a political decision to concentrate poverty and to concentrate black poverty in particular and to insulate it from white communities, that this was an alternative to the push for integration. Right? We had to provide new housing for blacks. One way to do that in expanding black population would have been to integrate the city. There wasn't a whole lot of will to do that in the 1950s and 60s in Chicago and other cities. So these high-rises were one way to take the pressure off the expanding black community integration. But there's lots of other factors involved, too. Kim?
Where they are in the city.
The
south side, you ever drive on
Dan
Ryan,
the passive is endless.
And it's the area around it is personal. Mm-hmm. It really is just totally warehouses.
Let me just say a couple of things about some things that people have already alluded to here about alternative ways of understanding what this means and what's caused it, okay? I think, let me just posit with you that there are three clusters of explanations out there right now. How has this happened? What perpetuates this? What's the problem? Which we really have to understand if we're going to do anything about it, okay? Clause number one, argued by a bunch of people, it has a long and resonant history in social science and in popular explanations of social phenomena, basically coming out of what's called the culture of poverty school, right? Did anybody see a Bill Moyers special? Was it on PBS or CBS last year called The Vanishing Black Family? Anybody? Is it CBS? The Vanishing Black Family. It's the best recent example, it seems to me, of a treatment of this kind of poverty as being caused by a culture of poverty. And the thesis essentially is that there's a sort of tangle of pathologies that exists here in this kind of place, that people's attitudes and behaviors feed each other in such a way that the negatives are magnified and that the attitudes and behaviors are such that you can never move out of this kind of situation. So you've got all of the sort of short time frame stuff. You've got all of the pathology of the family. People who want to do the tangle of pathologies talk a lot about the female-headed families as a key to the problem, and the disintegration of the family structure as a key to the problem, and the existence of the gangs. That what we have here is an interlocking web of behaviors that are behaviors of the people themselves in this situation, right? And that the thing to do, therefore, to get rid of this kind of poverty is essentially to change the behaviors and attitudes of the people that are in this kind of situation. That's theory number one. Theory number two is really a variant on that, I think, but a more sophisticated variant on that. I've got a lot of problems with that one, let me just say. We can talk about that. I've got a lot of problems with that first set of theories. Because, there was a marvelous book in the late 1960s or early 70s by a guy named Bill Ryan called Blaming the Victim. And that concept of blaming the victim seems to me to be exactly what the tangle of pathologies or culture of poverty theory does here. A second, though, variation on that argues that what we're really dealing with is migration patterns and the problems that arise when the peculiar migration patterns of blacks in particular get stuck in cities. And get overlaid with age patterns that mean you can't get this group into the economy. So the question here is a training question. It's a question of opening up training and education opportunities that takes advantage of or takes cognizance of the huge influx of blacks who were never, in fact, involved in the economy of cities. It's a little bit sort of stepping back from the blaming the victim set of pathologies to a sort of, well, it's about huge migration differences between this group and former ethnic groups, and it's about masses of minors and new economic challenges posed by all of the women, particularly looking for an economic place in this kind of community. The third explanation is the one that I started with. That is that what we have here is the direct result of the dislocation of major dislocation in the American economy caused by movement from an industrial capitalist economy to some kind of post-industrial capitalist economy, where none of the priorities, none of the economic priorities, contain attention to what's happening with the labor force at any level, let alone contain attention to what happens to the labor force at the bottom of the economic ladder. So Robert Taylor Holmes, from that point of view, simply stated, Robert Taylor Holmes is the direct result of the shining downtown boom in Chicago. Right? The creation of the shining downtown boom of Chicago has also created the underclass. And increasingly, then, we have two cities with a dwindling middle, black, white, and the other color, the gleaming downtown and the Robert Taylor Home. And that's the problem for the cities at this point. Yes? I think that quantitatively, it's it's a little bit different. But I was talking to people from Dayton who were up here. And most of the conversation with the people from Dayton sounded, I mean, I was asking all these kinds of questions with them about Dayton. And they described a city of 250,000 that sounded to me like Chicago. Yeah, slightly smaller. I think it's certainly a part of it. Let me give you one other image for how I understand what's going on, what the connection is between these major economic changes and the creation of this. You know, yeah, it's a classic thing to do in the United States to think about the economy as a ladder, right? And immigrant groups constantly come to the United States and grab on to the lower rung of the ladder and begin pulling themselves up, you know, even while they're still speaking Polish or German or something, you know, there's a job there, and they're pulling themselves onto the ladder of economic advancement. What I'm saying is, it seems to me that for the most part, there is no bottom rung on this ladder anymore. And that if you're stuck down here, there's no place to reach. You can't get... So what this is a whole community of people which is disconnected from the mainstream American economy. Disconnected. Marx used to talk about, one other image here, Marx used to talk about the reserve army of the unemployed, right? And the vision that the concept that he was driving at was that you had to have poor people like this, Marx thought, right? Because in a capitalist economy, you need to control the labor market. Industry needs to be able to control the number of workers as well as the amount of capital that you invest in making things, right? And so you always have poor people to keep wages down because people know at the bottom of the economy, the bottom of the labor market, that unless they accept a low wage, they could be out on the streets. So in that way, there was a reserve army of the unemployed that you can call them up when you need them and you can send them back on unemployment when you don't need them. I'm saying that even that sort of a concept seems to me to be totally outdated here, that this is a group of people that are not on reserve, not on call, not on National Guard duty for anything. There is no way that the economy as currently structured can use these people. These people have a wall between themselves and the functioning of the mainstream economy. It looks like about half of those people, when you sort of try to figure out mobility rates, about half of those people are kind of in and out of poverty. They're moving back and forth between sort of precarious working class kinds of status and back into poverty, and sort of, you know, there's some real, but the other half is the half that we're talking about when we're talking about the new, I think, the new and much more permanent poverty. And I really do think that the recent Asian immigrants is a very different kind of case, and we really have to be very careful in drawing conclusions from that case. I think there might be some similarities right now between those folks, the recent Asian immigrants, and the part of black population that moves in and out of poverty, right? They're sort of connected in some ways, but that bottom percentage, I think, is a different case.
So what you said about there being no bottom rung is plenty of hope.
Well, I think this is what's different. You know, when people ask, well, why are these folks? What's different about poverty now from when our forefathers and foremothers came over here and sort of scraped their way up? Well, the economy is different. I really think that our forefathers and foremothers would end up in the Robert Taylor homes today if they came over today with no resources.
Is it because we're talking about the industry controls it, like they take the business and go to a third world country, and because the minimum wage has gotten up to a certain level that they don't want to pay that.
Let me say 2 seconds worth about that. Thank you. It's the fourth point, global economics and the rainbow. Let me just, I've been playing with this in the last week, and I don't have it well developed at all, but the image I'm getting when I think, I spend some time in international terminals at airports. Do other people do that ever? Once in a while. I mean, not a lot of times.
Really?
Yeah, right.
God.
Right.
Let's go.
It was actually a ceremony that we were out there for the new one. watching people come and go. And one of the major shifts in the deregionalizing of the economy, it seems to me, the movement toward ever larger organizations that are above the nation state, that are supranational, whose loyalties first are to the business and only secondarily even to the nation. We're talking about the huge multinationals at this point. Is that the scope of the thing has expanded? The scope of the enterprise has expanded so that a whole different set of relationships between the economy and the people who are part of the labor markets in the economy is beginning to emerge. The instant mobility of capital across nations, right, has changed the way our economy thinks about things like investment, right? When billions of dollars can be exchanged like that, through telecommunications and computers, with no people even moving around, something is going on at the level of global economics which is radically new and which affects even this. So the image of the rainbow that I have begun to work on is, I see, back to my international terminal, most of the people in the international terminal are white. So I see two colors of the rainbow, green and white, floating around the globe with no attachment to place. I don't have any green here. With no attachment to place. Two colors of the rainbow, green and white, money and white people, have detached themselves from place, from a sense of turf, whether it's cities or whether it's nations or any kind of regional, even, economic structure. And down here on Earth, while the green and the white is floating around through international terminals and through telecommunications and off satellites, down here on the Earth is the rest of the rainbow, which does have white as part of it, but it's black, brown, yellow, red, and white. The rest of the rainbow is anchored to the turf. Place means something to us. These folks ain't going anyplace. Right? They're going to be there. They are not going to go through the international terminals, and they're not going to bounce off satellites. Yet their entire economic context is being determined by the detached, spaceless, placeless movement of capital and investment strategy to invest, to clothe through the ether. We've lost the sense of place in our economy. You don't invest in place anymore, or people. You invest in global context. So, of course, you can move the labor market around, right? Part of those 500,000 jobs that Chicago has lost have gone to the suburbs. Another part have gone to the Sun Belt, but an awful lot have gone to Korea or Mexico. External colonies of various kinds. And that's going to increase as the world in which those folks who go through international terminals becomes more and more separated from the world which is anchored to Earth.
let me
just do a bit. Well, let me just say one thing. Insofar as the welfare system, for instance, is implicated in the maintenance of this kind of reality, the good news is that more and more people know that. That is, the folks in Robert Taylor have begun to teach us that, and in fact, more and more people who make policy and who organize the impact policy know that. I think that there are humane directions for public intervention in people's lives that can replace the current welfare system. I like Massachusetts' experiment a whole lot. Yeah, I think Washington, from what I've heard, is not as good as Massachusetts, where you really are investing in unemployed people in a way that gives them enough resources and, most importantly, gives them real choices about which way to go to enter the economy. It seems to me to be, from what I know about the Massachusetts program at any rate, that it involves education and training and job creation and job placement and gives the folks themselves lots of choices, and it obeys the principle that I think is important in thinking about any of that, which is you never draw up a policy that has anything to do with poor people that you yourself would not want to be a recipient of. Right? If the policy seems like a good idea to me as a poor person, what I want it done to me, then it's probably an okay idea. Most of the welfare system, as it's now structured, is not something that I would want done to me or my family. Right? But so there are lots of policy examples, it seems to me, of people rethinking the public sector role, even in the midst of the Reagan years, which, you know, says that the public sector role shrinks. There may be some good out of that. The reevaluation of what, in fact, the public sector role is that's taking place now, beginning to bubble up in places like Massachusetts and even Washington, looks to me hopeful. I think, and I'll talk more about this on Friday if anybody's interested, I think the bubbling up of political energy out of black and brown communities in particular across the country and in cities is a terrifically hopeful kind of sign. I think the energy around a black definition of political participation getting to the table that gets energized around Jesse Jackson is a terrifically hopeful kind of sign. Now, there are all kinds of limits with those energies, but I think it's terrifically hopeful. Well, that's right, and that also, that is evidence of a very shallow notion of what he's about and how change happens. Thank you for hanging in there.
Very good.